Welcome to what I would say is a very special episode of Propaganda. That is episode 12, but we're doing one of our old current events kind of episode. Some news is going on. There was the Supreme Court has decided to not take up a case, McKesson versus Doe, today, and the impact that could have on protesting in the Fifth Circuit Court. There's a lot of things I don't understand about this case, and I'm very, very glad that we have Alec, who's going to be talking about Supreme Court structure at some point. And we have a special guest today, Sam Osier, the unconventional journalist. Sam, if you followed my work, you've known that I've interviewed Sam a couple times on shows that are way less serious than this one. But Sam, you are a journalist who covers protest movements and resistance and people who are fighting back against things that are happening in this country and oppression that is occurring within these marginalized communities. So let me first say thank you very much for coming onto the show.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for having me.
Yes. So I was hoping that one of y'all could kind of walk us through this case. I know it's from Louisiana. So Alec, you're based in Lake Charles. Do you want to talk a little bit about this?
I'll be honest. I didn't read the entire Fifth Court decision. It's about 60 pages, but I read some summaries. Just a basic background. McKesson was an organizer of a BLM protest back in 2020, in which an anonymous participant or person at the protest, we should say, it's not even clear if they're a participant, because the perpetrator that's at the center of the liability case was never caught, right? McKesson is just an organizer. And during this protest, a rock was thrown at a police officer who, according to this civil liability case, sued McKesson for damages incurred, medical bills, basically, right, for having this rock thrown at him. And you may have seen this in the news recently, because the Fifth Circuit Court's decision to throw out prior precedent, right, about the protection that protest organizers have from civil liability incurred if they don't meet a basic threshold of unruliness, basically, right? Like if you organized a protest that was the throw rocks at cops protest, right? I don't think any court would have a problem with them seeking some kind of a civil recompense if a rock in fact gets thrown at them, right? So if the protest is agitational by nature, right, that a jury can rule, or if you break some kind of other incitement laws, you wouldn't get this protection. But of course, right, we don't make throw rocks at the cops protests. We make political protests, and sometimes they get out of hand. So the case is also a little bit interesting because McKesson versus Doe, the cop's name is not Doe, right? But he's anonymous in a civil lawsuit. We don't know who this person is. Presumably, the court has ascertained this person's identity and is going out on a limb here to say this is a real person, and they, in fact, did get a rock thrown at them. But the public cannot verify that, right?
Yeah, and, like, for all we know, too, like, they could have, like, thrown the rock at themselves, you know, or, like, have, like, caused injuries to themselves because of the lack of transparency that they're having with the cop themselves. Which I think is interesting. Just like, the reason I say that is because there is a history of infiltration and setting up organizers and protesters with false accusations. And so, like, that's why I was like, because we don't even know who the officer is. For all we know, it could just be made up.
The rock thrower is anonymous, right? Because we don't know who mm-hmm. they are.
The right. The
police officer is anonymous. Within the confines of the lawsuit, it should be pointed out that this case was thrown out at a lower level of the federal judiciary and then made its way up to the Fifth Circuit, who then overturned its dismissal. Right. So I should actually know if this case has been if throwing out the dismissal basically as a status quo grants summary judgment against McKesson. But in any case, they intervened and have thrown out this prior precedent of liability shielding.
You talked about infiltration in these protest groups, and this is something that I've seen both sides of the political spectrum accuse the government of doing. And I was wondering if you had any examples that you could speak to of protest groups being infiltrated.
Yeah, for sure. In 2008, got this from The Intercept. They wrote a piece in 2020 about the United States and infiltration protests. In 2008, there was an environmental activist named Eric David, and he was sentenced to jail for 20 years for plotting damage at the Nimbus Dam in California. But 8 years later, the judge ordered him released because the FBI had withheld evidence regarding a government informant. And then in 2012, it turned out the FBI and its informant essentially created a plot to blow up the bridge in Cleveland and dragged five Occupy activists into it.
So on when you mentioned Occupy, I've been doing a lot of thinking about how there are more and more laws going up around the country that make it harder to protest, and they're targeting like big political actions and big protest movements. And it's the way that these things are framed. You know, we talk about propaganda and media on this show, and I can't help but talk about how these things are framed. And the earliest thing I can remember is during Occupy, when mainstream media finally did start talking about it and start covering it, they were painting these protesters as hippies, as burnouts. There was a lot of focus on the drum circle, very little focus being devoted to the actual, you know, financial and social things that they were challenging and protesting. And, you know, leading up to now, you've had President Trump calling protesters during 2020 thugs, saying, you know, go beat the fuck out of them, just advocating it in some small ways, advocating for, you know, using military force or National Guard forces to curtail these protests. And now I'm thinking about how post this decision, how this new propaganda going on, where I've been seeing on Instagram, where the people I follow are saying that like protesting is now officially outlawed in Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana. And I don't know if that's true or not. Sam, do you think you can tell me, is protesting actually outlawed following the Supreme Court kicking this decision back down to the Fifth Circuit?
So from what I've read, ever so technically, yes.
Okay.
Because basically the Fifth Court was like, this is what we want for these states. And the Supreme Court is not interfering because of their non-action. It's leading to this. I don't know how long or if people will take it seriously. Like, I don't know, because like ACLU and like other lawyer groups, like they're going to get ready to do something with this Fifth Court decision and the inaction of the Supreme Court. And because this news is so fresh, like I'm sure lawyers are trying to get it together to do some lawsuits to counter it. In the meantime, from what I've seen, it is technically outlawed. There's always like this transition period. Like I know in Houston right now, there are protests going on. Some are permitted, some are not. And I think from like a city to city basis, they would determine whether or not what level they want to execute law. If the protest is meeting the permit requirements and operating within the constraints of the law, then perhaps the city won't go full out with these protests is outlawed. But if we're speaking, like I have like the Palestinian protests on my heart, I would not be surprised if the city or whoever, whatever government entity is in charge in that state, in that city, would be like, oh, well, we have this precedent now, so here's a bunch of lawsuits for these organizers.
It's not necessarily that there exists now a law that says that protest is illegal, right? The first problem is that protest organizers can be held civilly liable for damages incurred, not just by cops, but presumably by protesting people, counter-protesters, bystanders, right? And that if a protest were to get out of hand, even if you don't know who committed the crime, and regardless of who it's committed against, you can be held civilly liable simply for damages having been incurred. There's no kind of blanket protection as given before to protest organizers from civil liability, given some basic restraints, right, about the lawfulness of the protest itself, right? And secondly, now that the Fifth Circuit Court has ruled that liability exists, this is a could be a jumping off point for municipal or state laws that want to say that protests of a certain manner are inherently dangerous, right? Because of this liability precedent, because of the lack of controllability, right, of even a police presence, right? This civil lawsuit is against a cop, right? So the cops were present at the protest. It didn't stop them from incurring liability to the police officers or disrupting the public state, regardless of what the intentions of the protest organizers were, that this could be a jumping off point for broader legal restrictions for protesting and crucially left to the designation of things like police departments or city municipal governments, right? People that, by the way, are not big fans of protests to begin with, right? This kind of decision is the thing where a city council or a mayor kicks back a question about the legality of a protest to a police department that then cites this and says, you know, these kinds of protests, we think, right, could be ones that incur civil liability on the part of protesters, and we're going to protect the protesters from themselves, right? Mm-hmm. If not bystanders and police officers from those protesters. That's the danger here, right? And so already, if you organize a protest, if anything bad happens, you could incur basically, you know, life-destroying civil liability. We don't know what the judgment in this case is yet. There is no judgment as far as I'm concerned, but the blanket removal of prior protection is the thing at issue here.
So taking a step back, so I mean, you make a good point. We would kind of like using the word law loosely. So legal precedent versus law. So I was thinking, you know, Roe versus Wade, when we had that, that was legal precedent for abortion protections before it got overturned. And then while we had this legal precedent, the Democrats kept using it as part of their campaigning about, you know, we're going to turn this legal precedent into federal law, which they never did. It got overturned, and now states are just willy-nilly about the issue. In this case, this legal precedent is enabling states to willy-nilly make their own laws if they want. And because the Supreme Court isn't stepping in, it doesn't necessarily stop any sort of laws coming out of it. But for now, it's just a legal precedent that doesn't protect anybody. That's kind of where we are, right, Alec, with the differences?
Yeah, we're basically left in limbo. I mean, you point out, I think, correctly, regardless of what ends up happening with this decision, the Supreme Court not hearing the case establishes it as legal precedent within the Fifth Circuit, at least, right? McKesson versus Doe is a case that could be referenced within other circuits and is essentially on the books now, at least within the states of Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And the ironic thing is, it's at least going to take another protest of this kind, right, where somebody sues for civil liability, for this to even be heard within the Fifth Circuit again. It should be said that this court decision carries with it a really incredible logic for the defendant, which is that the logic of the Fifth Circuit in overturning the lower court's decision, right, the reason that we're talking about this at all, is that the inherent logic of that upper court was that since the protest at which the anonymous police officer in this case was injured, since it became violent, that the organizer must have basically made a mistake or been reckless in its organization, right? A nonsensical logic, right? Where based on the outcome of a situation that you were not at all in control of, and that the court cannot prove you were negligent in organizing, right? It's not as though you knew for a fact that rogue, you know, people were going to show up to injure cops or that you planned to. They don't say that they can prove that, but that in the outcome somehow your organization of a protest leaves you liable. This kind of nonsensical logic. It's really surprising, right? And the fact that it's undoing, right, literally the right, you know, the first one enumerated in the Constitution should be talked about, right? Not just what it undoes, but the faulty logic therein.
I wanted to touch on something that you said earlier, Sam, about this being technically protesting is outlawed. It's like a technical kind of thing. And I think that it's fair to call it that because while protesting is not officially outlawed, it is shocking to see these state legislatures passing legislation to definitely make it extremely difficult. And if it's not something like, oh, well, if a protest turns violent and we're going after the organizer of it, then it is, we are charging protesters with domestic terrorism charges that we will never prosecute, but it will hang it over your head for years and years and years while you incur a bunch of fines and fees until eventually we throw it out. So it is all just one big intimidation racket. And I wanted to ask, like, has this occurred in a vacuum? Is this something that's been going on for years and years and years, or is this something that's only kicked off during the Trump administration?
No, it's definitely something that's been going on for years and years and years. Nothing ever exists in a vacuum. Like even the January 6th insurrection, that was a buildup, right? It was a buildup of the Trump supporters, and a week leading up to the insurrection, people were already at the Capitol, like supporting Trump and doing their thing. They were there over the weekend and it built up to that. Just nobody was paying attention, but they were there, and the security measures, they should have seen it coming. But nothing ever exists in a vacuum. So there's this, it's the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law. They have an analysis of U.S. anti-protest bills since 2017. And there's different trends in anti-protest laws. So you already touched on terrorism, but there's also traffic interference, which refers to creating new offenses and increasing penalties for interfering passageways, obstructing the flow of traffic, or making sidewalks, even sidewalks, impassable to pedestrians. There are some bills for camping. It's penalties, again, going back to the money, on a broad swath of activity not normally considered camping. They define camping as laying on a blanket or using any piece of furniture like a folding chair. And this is just used to restrict or ban nighttime vigils and other forms of peaceful protest. Then, you know, we have campus speech. We have police response. Preventing municipalities from inhibiting law enforcement response or failing to respond appropriately. There's even face covering bills, like penalizing people for covering their face to conceal their identity. And this is becoming a big thing with facial recognition on the rise. And just speaking of propaganda, I don't know if you guys have seen, oh my God, what's that movie? Oh, Coco. Where it's about Day of the Dead, there is facial recognition propaganda in that movie to try to normalize. The ancestors were trying to leave their dead place to go visit the altar in the physical place. And in order to do that, they go through facial recognition, TSA kind of vibes to get back to their families. Anyway, that's just like a side note on propaganda.
That's how they normalize it with children. They just yes. think like, no, we should go to the TSA machine. It's just like in Coco. Go.
Yeah, exactly. And so like them criminalizing face coverings at protests is also a big deal. Even like wearing a face mask for health reasons could be like penalized. So for that one specifically, I want to point out, like, it was 18 different bills in the U.S. 16 of them got defeated. One of them actually enacted. But this is part of it, right? Trespassing. And the trespassing one just is not fair. I remember during the George Floyd protests, police would actively corral protesters and organizers onto private property, which exists everywhere in Houston, and then call it trespassing. And that's a common theme. Driver immunity, damage costs, security costs, conspiracy, infrastructure, state liability. So these are all different trends of anti-protest bills that have been tracked since 2017, at least. Before that, I'm sure there were some anti-protest bills, especially like as Occupy was happening. But these are the ones that I was able to find that were actually tracked in a data-centric way.
I do want to touch on something that you said about the face coverings. So we talked about this on a previous episode, but I went to a vigil for Aaron Bushnell, and I did not wear a mask. And my face, Alec is smiling because it was kind of a crazy day when it happened. But I'll just assume some right-wingers, or maybe just some people who were trolls or didn't like Aaron Bushnell. Basically, someone in the DSA took my photo, put it online, and people online ran with it. And there were a lot of people making fun of me and drawing my face. Some of the drawings were pretty funny, Sam. Like, it was... It was actually
viral, Connor.
I did go viral for a little bit, but I couldn't help but think about, like, there seems to be a multifaceted offensive of like intimidation, be it from state government, be it from people with political opinions that are, you know, diametrically opposed to the protesters. And it all seems to be kind of a larger thing of, we can't outlaw protests, so let's just scare people into not protesting. Let's make them afraid. Let's bully them into submission. Let's make fun of their weird beard, alopecia tonsure, or whatever the fuck. They were poking fun at my beard. It was awful.
Well, and I mean, I think that goes back to what you were saying earlier about like protest archetypes, about like hippies and whatnot. And like, that's ammunition for the right to use. Even liberals to use, to be honest, when characterizing protests and activists. One of the ones in the media that come to my brain is Community, the show Community. And I forget her name. It's the blonde girl.
Britta.
Britta. Yeah. And even though like the show Community is meant to be satire and just like fun in general, whatever, people still take that archetype that Britta represents pretty seriously. Even in my circles outside of my political work, they see my political friends as like hippies who don't shower. And I'm like, you guys are so wrong. You have no idea how wrong you are.
Yeah, this is Houston. We have to shower. At the very least, we have to shower.
The very least. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Alec, what you got?
I think within the historical framework, it should be underlined how creative various groups who want to outlaw protesting get when it comes to a legal framework of defending and doing so, right? The First Amendment precedent is pretty clear, right? And if you poll the American populace, the right to protest is going to be incredibly popular. Right. At a baseline. Right. Before you talk about the politics of those protesting, maybe. So we can see, if you study the jurisprudence on this, the way that entities seeking to outlaw protest have moved goalposts or changed the logic of protest bans and the way that they go after shutting down protests. Right. The precedent that the McKinnison versus Doe case directly challenges is back from the civil rights era, right? It's NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware, right? In which case, a broad Supreme Court decision about the impossibility of protest given civil liability of protest organizers, right? Not participants who may break the law, but protest organizers, was established. And even in the 80s, right? This is 1982 when the decision's finally made. In an era that's progressed, let's say, since the 60s and 70s, at least a little bit, but is still, let's be honest, right? Like, pretty racist in terms of how it treats civil rights, the civil rights movement, and the ability of people, you know, especially in places like the South, right, to get rowdy in the streets about things that they care about politically. They established that essentially the First Amendment's right to protest is meaningless given this idea of liability. Now, in this case, the basis upon which the liability was incurred was like on antitrust law or something. Basically, right, a businesses said that that if you got a bunch of people together and they agreed not to sit at your lunch counter, right, or use your bus service, then that essentially is the same as John D. Rockefeller buying up all the railroads. It seems kind of patently ridiculous, but in a legal framework, it had to go to the Supreme Court to have a landmark decision made against it so that framework didn't work. And in the current day, it's not going to be surprising that you're going to see a move away from a business establishment point of view towards one of public safety, certainly, right? Of fighting with the police makes all of us less safe because the police aren't supposed to fight with people, I suppose, right? The idea that all protests have the inherent possibility of becoming violent and that affecting public safety is an argument. And then, I mean, you know, incredibly popular nowadays are a kind of propaganda about personal investment and time, right? The fact that you're not really made unsafe by somebody not letting you go to Starbucks, right? By sitting on the highway and doing a traffic jam. But what about first responders, right? What if a person like that was going to the hospital? And furthermore, it seems like people that comment on the kind of public protesting that environmentalist groups or civil rights groups or just political groups do when they're basically a public nuisance. The responses that you see in the comment section of people that froth at the mouth at this, right? People that just want to run you over with their F-150 for standing anywhere next to the street, much less in it, is often just about personal freedom, right? I have the right to move unmolested to the Starbucks. And if you stand in my way of doing that, regardless of your political purpose, I should get to run you over, right? I should be legally protected in undoing that inconvenience from my life. And the laws that come down hardest in since the Trump administration, but even before then, right, on protest, I think increasingly have that attitude of fighting personal inconvenience with security as a kind of secondary logic, right? The true logic behind them is nobody wants to be stuck in a traffic jam behind some jerks that are, you know, holding up Greenpeace signs or whatever, right? They're trying to tell me that global warming is bad, or, you know, you're funding a genocide somewhere in a country you don't really care about.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I'm at with that.
So my next question, you know, this is the Fifth Circuit, you know, this decision impacts Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi. These are conservative states. So this makes sense. Like, this stuff can't be happening in blue states. This stuff can't be happening in liberal states, right, Sam? Like, I'm sure Democratic legislatures across the country are protecting these kind of protest rights, right?
Oh, no.
Whoa, what?
Whoa, what? That's funny. Yeah, but like going back to these anti-protest bills that the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law, it's very long, put together, these bills, like the trespassing bills.
I mean, so, as far as I understand, some of these trespassing bills are used not just on, you know, whether or not you're in a Walmart parking lot, which is private property, right, arguably, but on public land as well.
Yes. Yeah.
That misuse of a public park, right? Something owned by the city. Presumably, if you're going by some kind of constitutional originalism, right, the place where one would protest, right? If it's not in the street or at a park in front of City Hall, where the hell do you protest, right?
Yeah, for sure. So New York, they had four anti-protest laws that they were trying to put in. New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Let's go over to California. California had one. That's surprising. Oregon had three. Washington, four. Who else is notoriously liberal? Connecticut.
What about Vermont? Where's Vermont at?
Let's look. Where are you, Vermont? You're so tiny.
I'd be surprised if you couldn't already kill protesters in Vermont, but you have to like do it with a snow plow or something. if you can like get them in a crab trap, then they're fair game.
I'm actually not seeing any for Vermont.
All right. Looks like we got to go to Vermont to protest unfair looking conditions in the South.
Looking at Zillow listings in Vermont.
Yeah, no, zero. Yeah, since 2017, they haven't even tried to like protest, like do any anti-protest laws.
Incredible. Well, I guess.
Way to go, Vermont. New Mexico, another one that hasn't tried. Maine.
I guess my very obvious setup there was a way of asking, what's the situation like in other parts of the country? What's the situation like in other parts of the world? Like, how do we compare to protesting around the world? And how does the South compare to protesting around the United States?
Oh, well, so to answer that question, we really need to look at like global capitalism, global white supremacy, because that is definitely taken a lot of the countries by storm. Everybody wants to be Western civilization. We also live in the imperial core of the United States, which is spreading our democracy throughout countries. I say that very sarcastically. It's not democracies that we're spreading. It is death. So overall, it's the same, right? Okay, so we have, you know, the United States, Israel, of course, Canada, which we don't ever think about Canada silencing protests, but students who are protesting, especially around like Indigenous rights, because Canada is notoriously anti-Indigenous, as the United States is, as every country is. But they had like state schools in which Indigenous children were found buried under the schools by hundreds. And there were protests going on there. And a lot of the same protest oppression that we're seeing in the United States was enacted upon them.
I think crucially in Canada as well, right? Canada is such a spread out and wide place that protesting on one of the basically two main highways that traverse east-west in Canada has been popular for decades, right? You can, you can almost shut down a transit across the continent in Canada by like posting up on Canada One and just having a bunch of people somewhere on the highway and get eyeballs on you.
Right. And I'm sure they incur a lot of like penalties and lawsuits from that as well as part of the suppression. In the United Kingdom, they use anti-terrorism scare tactics and laws to quell protesters. The Oregon State University put together a list of, it's called Mechanisms of Social Movement Suppression. And it's outlining the different modes of suppression that we can see, not just in our own history in the United States, but these different modes are tactically used across the world. So the first one is direct violence, right? So anytime you see something in China happening with the protesters, that's direct violence. That's like part of the playbook that we also use. The legal system, which we're talking about right now, it allows for harassment, arrest, public prosecutions and hearings, and just drowning people in fees, fines, not just from the state or the federal, but also from legal fees. Employment deprivation. People lose their jobs and can become like not hireable. Conspicuous surveillance. You know, they're always talking about Russia being like a surveillance state, covert surveillance. deception, mass media influence, information technology interference. So these are like all the different modes of protest suppression that is just used pretty much across the board.
Yeah, I can attest to you came on another show of mine and you told us that like anytime I start talking about, I guess, like FBI monitoring, like my internet connection will slow down. And sure,
the big
shit.
C word.
Yeah. And sure, shit, it happened. And I'm just like, ah, you're right. Very crazy.
Yeah. And like it still exists now. Like, I mean, I could drop the C word right now and our internet will probably break.
I also think
the C word is
COINTELPRO.
Really?
Yeah. It's like if you say Bloody Mary three times and like Bloody Mary like like appears, if you say COINTELPRO enough and like on a live stream or in areas.
It just cuts out.
I'm telling it, Alec, it happened.
It happened.
I'm not putting it past him.
I
like right it. Now, like I'm trying to see, like I've only said it twice now. So, but yeah, if you say it enough, it'll break your stream.
I'll have to try that sometime.
Yeah.
So when you were talking about the legal tactics, I did want to touch on RICO cases and and how in the wake of the Stop Cop City protest in Atlanta, there were talks of using RICO cases to charge lots of people in absentia with domestic terrorism. And I found that really upsetting, and I could not help but think when I was reading this article in These Times, the War on Protest, which check the show notes for all sources of stuff that we're talking about today. But I couldn't help make the connection to when the term Al-Qaeda was bandied about so that Osama bin Laden could be charged in absentia through RICO charges, and how Antifa is being used in this very weird organizational way instead of just like a philosophy of being anti-fascist, and how it seems to be they're creating it as this like it is a cultural Marxist organization that is looking to subvert this country, and they're coming for you and your kids. And I wonder if, you know, within our lifetime we'll see that like Antifa is declared a terrorist organization and RICO is used to come after people.
I really think we will. And the reason I say yes is because the Ku Klux Klan is still not considered a terrorist organization in the United States.
Oh, it would fuck up the banking system if they were declared terrorist organization.
Yes, exactly. So like all these white supremacist groups who actively have a history of of lynching and terrible white supremacist acts, like from their slave owning lineage, they are not considered terrorists in our country. And to me, when I look at our country, it's very militarized and it's very infiltrated. But I say infiltrated loosely because it's always been that way. So like the racists have always been in charge. I did this guest lecture at Houston Community College last fall where I told the students that the founders of our country were white supremacists. And I outlined exactly how they were. So for example, George Washington, we hear about how he had wooden teeth. He did not have wooden teeth. It was a mix of ivory teeth and black people's teeth. That's some white supremacist Nazi shit. This is what we're founded on. This is what our country is founded on. And, you know, we go a little further into the suffragette movement, right? The suffragettes, they were white women wanting to vote. But what did they do? They were part of the Ku Klux Klan, and they quelled the movement for black people to get to have the right to vote. You know, it wasn't until the 60s until that happened. So we long have a history of racism in our institution. So to me, it makes perfect sense that anti-fascists and anyone trying to fight and create a more equitable system would be considered terrorists.
it's getting really hard to not see the politicizing of going after these protests. I mean, I cannot help but think about the big one, January 6th, and how no one's being charged with, as far as I understand, no one's being charged with domestic terrorism. It's all trespassing of a public building. You see footage of Occupy protesters handcuffed, sitting on the ground as a cop just maces all of them or pepper sprays them. You see when people occupy, what was it, Ammon Bundy, when he occupied a federal building and, like, not a single shot was fired, nobody cracked down on them. Like, it is becoming transparent that you see there are certain political protests that get legally prosecuted and some that do not.
Yeah.
I think, like, you're talking about the historical context of protests in the United States, and I think there's quite a bit there that's very interesting. I mean, the United States has long, literally since its founding, has found itself, the state has found itself in a bizarre attitude of, one, tracing its legitimacy to a democratic founding that wanted to preserve some manner of civil liberties, right? Of printing presses, of, you know, owning arms, of not having soldiers, you know, stationed in your house, that kind of thing. And almost immediately after being incorporated, right? I'm thinking of, like, the Alien and Sedition Acts, you know, before the turn of the century even, right? We're already putting into place laws that directly kind of counteract, if not legally, at least in spirit, those founding principles, right? And the other thing too is especially now with the internet, but even before, I mean, you would see occasional, you know, news stories, right? Video of protests around the world. It's a bit ironic that the United States, at least in theory, has these founding principles that enable us to protest liberally, a legal tradition of protest that dates back to our founding, right? That is theoretically kind of ingrained in what the United States is supposed to be and how Americans see the state and their own civil rights. And the United States is largely a place that doesn't protest much, right? To show Americans videos of French people, for instance, right, turning over cars when there's a gas tax, you know, one of the immediate reactions is, well, why don't the cops just come out and shoot all those people, right? It's like, I mean, those people have less rights than you do, right? And that is, I mean, I'm not going to say that all Americans feel this way, but, you know, I'm a white guy who lives in Louisiana. It's almost ubiquitous among a white male population, that kind of response. And not just, let's be honest, right? Not just white people, right? That civil order ought to take precedent over the enshrined rights that are theoretically supposed to make America what it is, right? There's just a profound irony there that when it comes to actually exercising those rights, you see, well, let's say specifically the First Amendment, you see a huge public backlash, and that we have been trained and are continued to be trained by media coverage of, you know, Black Lives Matter in 2020. It was so conspicuous, right, that it was hard to deny. But, you know, even now in stuff like not just coverage of Palestinians themselves, but coverage of domestic protests about the war in Gaza, or, you know, I don't know. Do you want to use more live terms about Gaza? Let's just keep it to war in Gaza, maybe. Call it a war.
You can call, I mean, we've called it a genocide on past episodes.
Yeah, call it, sure. Fuck it. The genocide in Gaza, right? Just protests about that, right? Without a strong civil movement, right? It's not as though, you know, Palestinians have an enormous constituency in the U.S. state, right? It's not, look, I don't mean to be diminutive to the efforts of people protesting what is, you know, inarguably an enormous injustice, right? I mean, just a literal genocide, right? But it's not as though those people fundamentally threaten the American state or even, you know, support, broad-based support politically of Israel within the federal government, right? And yet, here they are being met with state force that, largely speaking, there is a continual basis for, right? And there will be continued propaganda to reinforce.
Yeah. So I've interviewed a few folks from the Palestinian youth movement, and particularly contextualizing the 75 years of colonization that they've experienced. And one of the things that they really helped me realize, because I honestly, I don't know why I didn't put the pieces together, but the way the media and like just typical talking points position it, it is a religious contention. It is between the Jews and the Palestinians about holy land. And the folks I was interviewing, they're like, no, that's what they're telling us. So we can see that it's this, but if we take it a step further, it's about colonialism. It's about the white supremacy. It's about, you know, manifest destiny. It's about upholding neocolonial statutes, if you would, in this modern day world. And the thing is, when we take it a level up from like a religious dispute up to colonialism and white supremacy, that's what overall the threat is. So like, even though we're over here protesting in the United States for Palestine, that's not actually seen as a threat to the United States, or it shouldn't. They know damn well that it is in fact a threat, because it protests and brings attention to the larger colonization and violence that comes with that, that the U.S. actively participates in. We colonized Hawaii. We have Puerto Rico, which is a colony, if you would. France has colonies. All of these empires, what are they called? Superpowers have colonies. And bringing attention to the fact that Israel is conquering and actively colonizing helps tie the dots back to the active colonies and colonizing that we ourselves are part of. And I thought that was just a really great point, because that's just another way in which media is amplifying violence, but also is complicit in colonization. Crazy, right?
Yeah, no, I don't know. Someday maybe we'll have an episode about Israeli propaganda and what Israel means to Americans and the American state. Israel, so many different things. You know, you could talk about for hours all the different facets that Israel kind of fills in the American state.
Well, and like, even like their Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, coming over to train, like they've trained HPD.
God. I mean, Israel is just a fundamental feature, a pillar of, you know, the 20th century American military industrial complex.
Yeah, that we're funding.
In so many ways that, you know, I mean, the subtext behind a lot of that funding is, you know, look, man, we make Iron Dome missiles in my district. Right. Like,
well,
these are good customers and we're customers of theirs. And it's a reciprocal relationship. You know, I mean, this is
coming back to the protesting, like the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, and the military, they do cross training on how to suppress protests. And that funnels down to local police. The cop city that we have in Houston, it was cross-training by the Israeli Defense Force. The cops that they're trying to put in Atlanta right now, also cross-training there. So just as much as we're cross-training as much as we can, especially like in the abolitionist movement, they are definitely already on top of it.
I mean, what you said about, you know, restrictions on protesting going forward, I see a through line with stuff that we've talked about in the past. You know, both this kind of a very apparent admission, even amongst protesters, that we don't have much control, met with a kind of, you know, nearly unilateral state, either state violence or state legal response, right? I only see that kind of ratcheting up in the internet era, right? An era in which, for the first time, the effects of American policy, at least in foreign policy, but domestic as well, right, can be seen in video form right, instantaneously, and don't have to be channeled through the gateways of a media press, right? One that is on some level always connected to the state and always kind of runs interference for one. I think on some level, I don't think it's a driving feature, but I think that has something to do with the TikTok ban that we've talked about before, which is at least in part a frustration by propaganda machines about a vector for political, if not activism, then at least awareness that is largely outside of their control.
Yeah. So like the TikTok ban is like one of my favorite things just because it's an algorithm that the United States and its corporate subsidiaries don't control. Right. And that's why they hate it. But I remember there for a second, TikTokers had read Saddam Hussein's letter.
Bin Laden's letter, my bad.
The Guardian, and that had gone viral, and that was just like maybe like 2 or 3 months before they actually did the ban, which I thought was really interesting.
So with these decisions being made and these cases being kicked back, it sounds like protesting is just getting harder and harder to do. So I wanted to ask you, what are some things protesters can do to insulate themselves from these new rules?
I honestly have no idea. A lot of organizers who have been in the thick of this for a while have already been operating as if they are not allowed to mass protest. Because given all of the suppression tactics that we've listed and given just how terrible it already is to protest, organizers who are already in the thick of it, they have community networks. So like they have an idea of like who might be going to jail, and they have like certain levels of danger for a protest. So like this is a high risk protest. We're actively blocking employees from entering a building. If you're going to show up to this protest, here are the things that you need for when you get arrested. So like you need some call numbers, you need a lawyer number, you need to make sure you have your bills in check, right? So make sure your job knows, make sure you have your PTO as best as you can, whatever support you need while you get arrested, try to get your ducks lined up in a row. And this is for like high risk actions. And even though each individual organizer has their plan for when they get arrested, there's still a plan for jail support. So people who didn't go to jail at these high-risk actions, these jail support folks are monitoring them while they are in jail to make sure they don't die, because that's a real thing. And then once they get out of jail, making sure they have the resources and support that they need for it. So high-risk protests like blocking off employees from entering a building, for example. And so moderate level protests would be like the George Floyd protests, where it starts off peaceful and then people just kind of silo off into whatever. So the reason that's more moderate is because people aren't going in there knowing that they're going to get arrested. They're going for a peaceful protest. It may or may not be permitted, but they're going in there knowing that they're not at super high risk. But even then, the organizers who are already in the thick of it know that every protest is technically a high-risk protest. So they have jail support. All throughout George Floyd protests in summer 2020 in Houston, there was a jail support group outside of the county jail ready for folks. And that jail support went on for about 4 or 5 months before it was no longer needed in that capacity. Jail support is always needed, but in that capacity it was no longer. And then you have the protests that are not considered risk at all. So like the Women's March, where they actively worked with the police to secure permits, to block off roads, or like the Science March. Like I was communication director for the Science March in Houston. Like we actively worked with the police and with the city and with the county to make sure everything would be safe and everyone would be safe. We worked with the carceral state to make sure safety was fine. And like at the time, I really didn't think about jail support. It was in my earlier days. But even then, more seasoned organizers would say, if you're wearing a face covering, if you do any sort of trespassing that they consider, if you're just like black or brown or you look a certain way, they just still prefer to have jail support just in case. Organizers who have been in the thick of it have always been acting and moving as if this legal precedent has happened. So just making sure you have jail support, making sure you have something like just support in general. Like if you end up in jail for a few days, what does that look like? Writing a number on your arm. But besides that, these things, these tactics that organizers have already been doing because they've already been in the thick of it, I don't know how you can insulate yourself from this. I really don't. Try to have a connection at ACLU. And the thing is like when you're in a protest that wasn't like everybody just met for the protest, it wasn't actively organized or marketed, and there isn't a clear leader on who is leading the protest, the police will still pick them off one by one. I went to a Palestinian protest, covered it with Status Quo about 3 months ago, and we all just met. It wasn't clear who the leader is, but they basically targeted the people with the megaphones, and they're like, hey, we need your ID. We need to see your face. And then they tried to separate people who were like the loudest from the group to like talk to them. And that was before this legal precedent happened. Right. So this legal precedent wasn't surprising for me when it happened because we've already been living in that reality.
I mean, I think one of the ironies about this is it constraining legal avenues of organizing, you know, for the security state is going to lead. If protests erupt in that way and are less controlled or less organized by individuals because of precedent like this, guess what? They have a higher tendency to be violent than not, right? If you can't organize peacefully and people march out in the street just because they are so pissed off that they're not waiting for somebody to organize, that's when violence happens more often than not. But is the security state as it exists right now really against that, right? If you're in the police union and you supposedly care about cop security, you know, are you really that upset if protests turn violent and you can, you know, crack down harder? If you can stomp down with the boot harder?
Like, oh, yes, I can finally use my training and my new toys.
Finally, the IDF taught me something I can use. Mm-hmm. I did want to ask Alec if you wanted to discuss how these different levels of courts work. I mean, we talked last night on the phone about what does it mean to kick a decision back to the Fifth Court? Does the Fifth Court have to follow through with what the Supreme Court says? Are there examples of courts saying, no, we're going to keep doing our own thing and bucking the orders of the Supreme Court?
Just a bit of flavor. So I didn't used to be a lefty, let's say. When I was in high school and college, I was pretty much a single issue gun voter. I'm probably not that way anymore, but I'm a firearms enthusiast. I like historical firearms. And whenever your politics are based on a single issue, it's kind of easy to get suckered into thinking, you know, both sides are bad and the side that I like is the side that, you know, supports my hobby. So it shouldn't surprise anybody that I know, you know, maybe more than the average person about gun law, still left over from that. And it's always surprised me a bit that Americans, especially nowadays American liberals, right, put so much stock in the judicial system as a means in and of itself for social change that comes as a reaction to legal decisions, right? Largely because the courts don't work very well, let's be honest, right? The federal court system is really fraught, to say the least. And this decision is a good example of the baseline of that kind of friction, right? You have what is essentially, at this point, 40 years of court precedent based on a kind of landmark case that defines and shapes one of these aspects of the courts that they hold very closely, right? Even conservative courts, even the Federalist Society or whatever, they have a kind of kayfabe about themselves that they are defenders of civil liberties at the very least, that the court is neutral, right? Even Federalist guys, by the way, don't like it when courts discriminate based on race, at least overtly, right? They don't like for courts to be seen that way. And they like to be seen as defenders of civil liberties. The fact that this Fifth Circuit case seemingly comes out of nowhere and has potentially enormous implications on civil liberties, and that a Supreme Court stacked with, conservative, federal justices, a Federalist Society justices, for instance, right, won't hear the case, and that has this redounding impact where we're left questioning, is one of the fundamental rights, American rights, just abridged in one of these regions of the United States because of this bizarre court decision? So in 2022, during the kind of the middle of the Biden administration, the Supreme Court again made a decision in New York, right, that batted down New York gun laws, right? They reaffirmed, by the way, a decision that was made in 2008 at the very tail end of the Bush administration. That was a landmark gun case, right, by the way, which basically made the decision that that classes of firearms, right, could not be banned, right? That firearms that are used ubiquitously by legally by American gun owners could not be writ large banned. Basically, that you can't ban assault rifles as a class, right, or assault weapons, right? Semi-automatic rifles can't be banned as a class. Handguns can't be banned as a class. If they're ubiquitously used, you have to allow them to exist. The weird thing here is that certain circuit courts, right, after that decision, just didn't enforce it, right? You have, at least in theory, this supreme judicial legal body. It literally decides what can and can't be law in the United States. Under it exist these circuit courts, right? So in this case, I'm thinking of the second, that's New York, the third, New Jersey, that had some pretty restrictive firearms legislation passed, and the ninth in California, all of which had gun control legislation that seemingly went directly against the 2008 decision, DC versus Heller, right, is the one I'm thinking of. And the circuit courts therein just wouldn't uphold any lawsuit based on that Supreme Court decision, right? You would go as a gun owner and you would petition a federal court. You'd say, look, this New York City law, this New Jersey gun law is unconstitutional on paper, right, by what the Supreme Court said last year or 2 years ago. Undo this law. It cannot stand, right? It's unconstitutional. And the circuit court would just say, no, we don't acknowledge that Supreme Court decision, right? And if the Supreme Court doesn't hear you, if they don't grant you audience, that case audience, that decision stands. So you have, and especially I think for liberals who, after things like Obergefell and various, other kind of progressive landmark decisions, things that we feel good about because the United States has seemingly changed socially, right? But that are decisions of the courts that are not legislative, that are not based upon the impact of our political leanings and actions, but based upon a kind of legal logic that, let's be honest, right, is kind of beyond most of us, right? And certainly not political in the way that we talk about. That this is built on sand, right, basically. That victories therein can simply be not acknowledged by circuit courts and can remain not the law of the land based on what a lower level of the same structure believes. In Obergefell, for instance, right, it is totally possible that a circuit court, let's say it's controlled by, a Trump appointees, right, could just say, that you have a lawsuit, you're suing this administrative body of a municipality or the state, right, that's supposed to legally grant a marriage license between gay couples. We just throw it out. We don't acknowledge it, right? We don't believe them, right? And we think it's still constitutional. And unless the Supreme Court hears that case, no dice, right? Let's say the Supreme Court hears that case. You just do it again, right? How many cases can stack up in the federal judiciary that the Supreme Court has to hear each and every time, right? To the point where the legal standing at lower levels simply doesn't get there, right? Where the system doesn't work to begin with. And I'm not saying this to, you know, minimize historical victories attained through, you know, Supreme Court decision. Unfortunately, in the United States, that seems to be most of them in the modern era. But it needs to be pointed out here, as before, that a lot of this issue is fundamentally structural, right? It has to do with the way that the United States structures its law and makes political decisions and defers those to courts, right? And as long as you have that structure, and as long as the court goes against, you know, if you're a progressive, goes against your progressive sensibilities. If you're a, you know, a gun rights advocate, let's say, right, it goes against your, you know, ability to exercise your Second Amendment right, right, of one again in the Constitution. You're going to see these problems.
Great. Very good.
Sorry, I don't want to make you depressed, Sam, but the structural issue is so like mentionable. I don't know. I don't know how we don't talk about it more. Nobody wants to talk about it.
I'm so beyond being depressed. There's a lot of things that I read and know that, like, yeah, it's all good. It's all chill.
Me too. Me too. So coming off of 2020 and the Black Lives Matter movement, and then now with Gaza protesting, for instance, right, as two broad and recent examples, I mean, I have to say, protesting itself, right, petitioning the state for redress and making yourself heard, I mean, it feels more impotent than we had at first imagined. I mean, it feels the most impotent that it has been in my lifetime since I was in college, basically. And despite that feeling of impotence that I think some people share, that maybe some listeners share, we're seeing this increased backlash. How can we make sense of that kind of irony, right? That on one side, it doesn't feel like we're being listened to at all. It doesn't feel like, you know, basically anything happens when we protest, except they make a bunch of news that makes us, you know, sound like, you know, we just want to burn Walmarts down. And despite that fact, protesting is becoming more and more criminalized. I mean, how do we make sense of that seeming paradox?
I find a lot of comfort in history. A lot, sometimes people don't, because it's like, oh, it's always been here. It's never going to go away. But I kind of find a little comfort in that. Even like I'm thinking of 1800s union busting. So when unions were out there rioting and fighting for better wages and like our 9-to-5 and weekends, there was an increase of police departments being created in the North. So at the height of union riots, that's when all of our core Northern police departments were created, because they were created specifically to bust these unions for trying to get better wages. And sure, like at the time, they probably felt that impotence too, right? Because they are over there trying to make money and spend time with their family. And police departments are legit being created in real time to beat them. I'm also thinking about the Stonewall riots. I'm thinking about how, even though the Stonewall riots happened and it brought attention to their movement, the AIDS crisis still happened. And that generation was wiped out. That protesting, that riot, who the people who were there, like, I'm sure they felt an amount of impotence. So 420 is always my reminder that I've been in the movement. It's my anniversary. And I just hit my 8-year of being in the work. And I started off as a cannabis activist. I did permitted protests. I worked with cops. I have pictures with me with the cops in my early days. And I marched, and weed wasn't getting legalized, and I felt impotent. And then, you know, the George Floyd protests happened. And at the time, like, I was a journalist. I wasn't a electoral or cannabis activist, and I witnessed HPD pepper spraying a woman in a wheelchair. What was that for? And here we are a few years later after George Floyd protests, and we haven't seen any sort of abolition, let alone sweeping reform. What was that for? I think protesting is, when I first started doing protesting, like the Women's March, the cannabis marches, all the ones that I went to, I don't go to protests as much anymore, but all the ones I went to, I was angry and I was upset and I just wanted to be around people who were also angry and upset and wanted to bring attention to this issue. And being in a community of thousands of people in the same space was affirming for me because it was like, hey, we all see this war that's happening, whatever war it is, war on women, war on Gaza, war on whatever. We all see the war that's happening, war on drugs, war on Black people. And I think we all cycle through that. I think protesting is a great way for people to kind of get their feet wet and figure out what's what. If you're listening to this and you go to protests, please just look up how to be safe at protests. There's a lot of resources that organizers like me and others who have been out here for a while that they've put together to keep you safe. And it's guidelines that you should take to be safe. So you're not out there willy-nilly, because as you can see, these lawsuits, this legal precedent is definitely going to be worse. But then over time, you know, once you're kind of done with protests, there's still work ahead. Like all these things that I talked about, these organizations building and creating spaces where they didn't have it, that's the work that comes after the protest. So even if the protest seems useless, it at least made immediate impact. It at least planted some seeds, and it at least got you started down your path to make something more sustainable in the work that we have now.
My next question for you, Sam, is with all these, anti-protesting legislation popping up across the country, I got to ask, are there new ways we can fight back? Because I can only think of in terms of cybersecurity, no matter how well you build a firewall, there is always someone who will be able to get through it. And that's the constant war of escalation of cybersecurity is a weakness is exploited. We patch over that weakness and then another crack emerges. So what are some ways that we can still protest while avoiding these new restrictive measures?
So the foundational thing that I always come back to is turning to abolitionist theorists like Miriam Cobb, We Do This Till We Free Us book, and turning to people who are already doing this work, particularly Black and Brown women who have been writing about imagining a world outside of what we're given. Some ways that that's already been happening. So when we think about abolition, we immediately think about like tearing down, like we must abolish a state. And that's what it is. But there needs to be something there. So abolition is more about creating spaces and communities and infrastructures that we need to combat what it's existing and to kind of show like, hey, we don't need this anymore, because we created this. So for example, in Chicago, they have community courts where they are working on a community court system and building it and trying to make it community-based instead of carceral-based. So that way it's not funneling more people into the prison industrial complex for slave labor. Another way, interrupting criminalization, they are actively working on media tools to help journalists not report on more propaganda. They are working on systems and ways that, like juvenile detention centers, they are working on different outlets. So kids don't go into those juvenile detention centers. They get rerouted into their program, which is not carceral. I'm thinking of the Upend movement here in Houston, where it's social work based, but instead of like funneling people to CPS, they're trying to build systems of accountability where kids don't go through CPS or the social work institution that we have. It goes through other places. The nursing co-op founded by Sada Richards, also here in Houston, it's in-home nursing workers, and they have created this co-op where it's outside of the existing medical nursing home institution to where they can be more present with their patients at the homes that they need to be in without profit in the bottom line being a factor. I'm also thinking about, again, Asada Richards. Y'all need to look her up in Houston. She is bomb. Community trust funds in Houston. That is what her and like the team and folks, community that she's with, to combat gentrification and what the tax increment reinvestment zones are doing. Even All Real Radio, where I report, where I do my reporting, that was founded because KPFT was very racist and DJ Zen decided to find his own space and create it. There's a lot that you can do outside of protesting. You can create your spaces. In Galveston, there's a few folks I plan on interviewing coming up soon. But I was talking to Felicia, who I'll be interviewing at some point, and she was talking about how in Galveston, they've largely gate-kept Galveston from Black and brown people who are living there, and Black and brown people are having to leave Galveston because it's getting more and more unaffordable. And so she's actively creating spaces. They just had their second or third annual Black Empowerment Festival about a month ago. Coming up in May, they're going to have their Brown Voices Board of Education 70 years anniversary to make space to celebrate that and to make space for the community members. Brazoria County last year, they don't have any resources for LGBT communities in Brazoria County. People who live in Pearland who have closer proximity to Houston have some resources for LGBT things. But people who live in Lake Jackson or Surfside, they're shut out of luck. So last year, Brazoria County Pride put together their first Pride Festival, and they plan on having a second one this year. And they plan on expanding out resources so the LGBT community in their county actually has something tangible for them. So there is a lot of ways that we can go about building a better world for us. Protesting is great because it brings attention and demands attention for issues that are at stake. And everyone has a time and a place in their movement. I'm not over here trying to shit on organizers or protesters. You do what makes sense for you, but also know outside of protests, there's a bunch of work going on to build the world that we are imagining.
Great. Now,
yeah, very passionate about that one. I report on the movements that fight back, and that's tapping into people, creating spaces in which they don't have. It's just...
Well, on that uplifting note, Sam, I want to thank you for coming on to Propagandos. We really appreciate it. Where can our listeners find you?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I love propaganda and I love talking about this stuff. So I really do appreciate having more space to just nerd out because it's important that it's important stuff to talk about. It really is. So to find me, you can look up Unconventional Journalist Houston. You can look up Sam Oser, O-S-E-R. You can follow me at Sam the Mullet. That's like business in the front, party in the back kind of mullet. So at Sam the Mullet. I'm mostly active on Instagram. I do post sometimes to Twitter and Facebook, but Instagram is my happy place. And I do go live on All Real Radio every Saturday at 1:30 Central. So yesterday I did a live interview with Courtney from Bayou City Water Keeper about Houston's pending water crisis. And that's up for replay. You can look up Unconventional Journalist wherever you get your podcasts. And the interview is up there for replay, along with links on how to get involved and more informed. But that's the skinny on it. I've been thinking about creating a website for myself to kind of house, because I'm also like a marketer. I do a lot of different things to house everything in one spot. But that's coming soon.
All right. Well, we can't wait. We can't wait to get our eyes on that. Hopefully we'll be able to share that with our audience whenever that comes around. And if you ever want to talk about like movies or something that's propaganda, you're more than welcome to come back. We're mostly a movie review podcast. So, you know, we love talking about propaganda and things.
Oh my God. Okay. I would totally be on board for that. My favorite propaganda is children's TV.
Yeah.
And cartoons. So like I'm rewatching the Avatars. I was just talking to my friends about Owl House. Mm-hmm. It's an abolitionist TV show that Disney canceled. And it's really good. But I try to find like happy propaganda things. Cause when I'm decompressing from life, I want to watch kid shows. But I'm happy to talk about other propaganda as well. Yeah.
Great. Okay. Well, that about does it for this week's episode of Propaganda. Sam, thanks again. And everybody listening at home, we'll catch you next time.
Thanks so much, Sam.
Thank you.